drought in Iran means taps are running dry in the capital.
It seems that God has turned off our utilities.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, the water crisis in Tehran. Also, a firsthand account from the front line in Ukraine as the war with Russia grinds on.
If you think about this war as a contest for kilometers, that seems to go nowhere. But remember this. This is war for survival.
In honor of apple pie, we make a Thanksgiving visit to the birthplace of the fruit. It's nowhere near the U.S.
This apple's a little rotten, but I'm going to try it anyway. It's good. For a rotten apple, it's very good.
Plus, a tribute to a reggae legend.
Did not tell you I was going to be famous one day.
We remember Jimmy Cliff, all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We are glad you are starting this holiday week with us.
We begin in drought-stricken Iran, where officials are calling for urgent assistance to extinguish fires raging through ancient woodlands, the Hyrkanian forest in northern Iran. It's not just the blazes raising concern, though. Iran's water crisis has become so severe that last week President Masoud Pezeshkian said Iran's capital must be moved because the country no longer has a choice. That's after a previous suggestion to evacuate Tehran's nearly 10 million residents.
A resident of the city joined us today to offer perspective from inside the parched capital. We have had him on the show before, and to protect his safety, we are not revealing his name. We began by asking how the drought is affecting daily life in Tehran.
In some areas of Tehran, the water is cut from 9 p.m. up to 6 a.m. in the morning. So it's very hectic. Everybody is really afraid because water and air are the essentials of life. So it is very scary.
You mentioned air. You're talking about poor air quality and smog?
Exactly. Just a couple hours ago, they have closed down schools tomorrow and until the wind blows or something happens. It's just like inside of a wood oven with all the smoke and everything.
The smoke, is that wafting toward Tehran from these forests that are on fire in northern Iran?
Initially, I didn't think that. But this morning, I traveled about 60 miles west of Tehran, and it was even worse over there. And the air smelled like burnt wood. So I think it is adding to the other pollutants in the air.
And what is usually the cause of that smog, and why is it worse when it's so dry?
We are actually reeling from the mismanagement of the country for the last almost 50 years, post-1979 revolution. And this mismanagement and the oligarchy, they have allocated the wrong surface water to different cities. They have mismanaged agriculture. And also the Tehran water system, about 30% of the water is just gone to the ground because all the pipes are old. Most of the pipes are from prior to the revolution. They break and all these things. This is for the water. For the air, they cannot make good cars. Instead, they make missiles. It's that plus the factories around Tehran and major cities. Plus, these people have made Iran isolated from the rest of the world. So everything added together, and now the smoke from the fires. And so it seems that God has turned off our utilities. So this is making Iran as a whole is becoming polarized a lot. And, you know, it's just creating some hate between different parts of the society, which is not very good.
How are people dealing with this lack of water and also the poor air quality?
For the water, we just save something for the night in small tanks or bottles, or at least washing our face or drinking it during the night if we become thirsty. It's just like going backward to, I don't know, 200 years ago. It's as if the Qajar dynasty is coming back.
This news that the president, Masoud Pezeshkian, is saying that Tehran will need to be evacuated and the capital will need to move, that is a striking statement. How are people reacting to that there on the ground? Are they taking this seriously?
We don't take anything that Mr. Pezeshkian says seriously. because everything which he has said during his campaign is now reversed.
Does anyone think that eventually the city will have to be evacuated or relocated?
No other city is safe except if you go to the coast. But there is no infrastructure. They have not been doing anything on the infrastructure for this day. So where do we go? Because Isfahan has the same problem. Mashhad has the same problem. Ahwaz has the same problem. Tabriz has the same problem. Where do they want to go?
You mentioned that people are saving water. I'm wondering if, for example, schools are still operating, if there are outdoor sporting events, or if those are canceled due to air quality. Like how else is life being impacted?
Today, they announced that all the schools would be through the internet, but the internet connections are very weak. You know, they cannot do anything right. They say that you just sit home and stare at your laptop, and many people can't afford a laptop. So it's a big mess.
Is there something that you wish people outside of Iran could understand about what you are experiencing right now?
One thing which we would appreciate that all the Western media, please refer to the people of Iran as Iran and to the government and the regime, the Islamic Republic. Make them separate because we have been suffering the most out of these sanctions, which are not at all smart sanctions. They're affecting normal people because no one in Iran is making those missiles but the government. No one is spending $1 billion of our money and sending it to the Hezbollah of Lebanon, but the government, the regime, the Ayatollahs.
Thank you for that explanation. What kind of support do folks there in Tehran have to help them cope with all this, both, you know, their material needs, but also their psychological health, their mental health?
Good thing is that people help each other in a way. We haven't lost our minds yet. So people support each other. We still go to restaurants. We still go to coffee shops. We'll still go to work if it's not closed because of the pollution, or if we have water, or if we have electricity. Now, when it gets colder, we will have gas shortages. So there goes our heating systems. So people are just relying on each other. Otherwise, we feel isolated, and we think that we're lonely in the world. If the Westerners want to keep on going with the sanctions, they have to make them smart. It's not working right now for us.
A resident of Tehran describing the impact of drought in Iran's capital city of 10 million people. Stay with us for more on climate change, what progress the international community was able to make the past 2 weeks at the COP30 climate conference in Brazil. That is later this hour.
You probably know the phrase, starving artist. For many people working in the arts, it's not far from the truth. Making a living as an artist is only getting harder in many places. A few years ago, the government in Ireland tried to help by paying artists about $1,500 a month. The idea was to buy them some time to make progress on their work. About 2,000 artists participated, and now the Irish government wants to keep the program going. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, has more.
2020 was going to be a big year for Dublin playwright Lisa Tierney Keogh.
I was at a point where I'm about to have a show go on at the Abbey for a long run.
The Abbey is Ireland's national theatre, and having a play staged there could be life-changing. At least that's what Tierney Keogh thought. But COVID had other plans.
The cancellation was devastating. Absolutely devastating.
Theatres across Ireland closed for more than 15 months. And for artists like Tierney Keogh, the work just dried up. In 2022, the Irish government introduced a basic income scheme aimed at getting at least some of those artists back on their feet. 2,000 people were randomly selected. Tierney Keogh was one of them.
I remember the day I got the email, it was like my heart jumped in a happy way for the first time in like a couple of years. I felt like I had some hope and I felt like somebody believes in me.
Tom Meskell, a visual artist based in Mayo in the west of Ireland, was in Philadelphia at the time, staying with a fellow Irish artist. And early one morning, they discovered they'd both been chosen for the programme.
We had this lovely, we called it dancing in the kitchen. It was like about 6 in the morning, their time. And we both kind of met each other in the kitchen saying, did you get it? Yeah, did you get it? Yeah. And we were dancing. We just knew how significant it would be to us.
Meskell, who has two kids, says it was like a massive weight suddenly fell off his shoulders.
I think any self-employed person can relate to this. You're constantly trying to think about 6 months in advance about keeping everything going. It was amazing. I've never had security of work before.
The public was incredibly supportive too, he says, although some listeners who called into Irish radio were not so happy.
Brian, for instance, he's got in touch to say, if you can't make a living out of what you do, maybe rethink your choice. Nobody helps me put food on the table. Another listener says, if you can't make money as an artist, then perhaps change career.
Still, last month, Jack Chambers, an Irish government minister, announced the programme would be made permanent.
In recognition of the essential role of arts and artists in our society, the previous government introduced a pilot basic income for the arts scheme, and this government is now committing to deliver a successor scheme to begin next year.
A government report found that the artists involved in the scheme earned more from their work, relied less on social welfare, and reported feeling better overall. It was a win-win for the artists and Irish society, the government said. Most basic income schemes, though, never make it past that pilot stage.
I guess the issue, though, is the cost.
Andrew White is a senior lecturer in culture and media at King's College London. In 2017, Finland ran a basic income programme for unemployed Finns. Over the two-year trial, happiness levels did go up, but most participants didn't find work. And then the government asked if the plan should be extended.
You know, if we extended this, if we rolled it out to the whole population, would you be prepared to pay to the increases in taxes that would require?
The Finnish public was not so enthusiastic. Ultimately, the scheme was dropped. Ireland stands out too, White says, because the programme gets widespread political support. But some artists say it's not as rosy as it sounds.
The overall funding to the arts in Budget 26 hasn't increased from last year, which means that, you know, if you take into account inflation, it means that we've essentially had a cut to the arts.
Visual artist Eleanor O'Donovan from Cork says the scheme was a good start, but it should be opened up to all 8,000 or so artists who originally applied and were considered eligible, she says. Playwright Lisa Tierney Keogh says she's afraid the Irish government won't stick to its promise to make the scheme permanent. The project, she says, is about more than just money.
To have just that bit of income coming in saying, you know what, we see what you're doing, we recognise it and keep doing it, it is massive, absolutely massive.
It's about feeling valued as an artist, she says, and that's not something she sees every day. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
What did and did not get done at the UN's recent climate conference? That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. There is no roadmap for transitioning away from fossil fuels. That is the headline from the UN Climate Summit, COP30, that wrapped up in Brazil over the weekend. Carolyn Beeler has been following the negotiations from our newsroom. Carolyn, that seems like an odd takeaway for COP. Tell us more about that headline.
Well, at the beginning of the UN climate summit, Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, set that expectation for a roadmap here.
The world needs a clear roadmap to end this dependence on fossil fuels.
He called for negotiators to come up with a plan to move away from coal, oil and gas, Marco. Now, some 80 countries were on board with this, but by the time the summit wrapped up on Saturday, there was no direct mention of fossil fuels in the final text that countries agreed to. Now, at the end of these things, COP organizers always try to put something of a positive spin on the results. But the COP president, André Correia de Lago, you know, acknowledged that this was likely a disappointment for many people.
We know some of you had greater ambitions for some of the issues at hand. I know the youth civil society will demand us to do more to fight climate change.
So where does that leave efforts to move away from fossil fuels, Carolyn?
Well, of course, these COPs will continue. There will be another one next year. And Brazil did say that it would lead a voluntary effort outside of the official UN process to develop this roadmap to move away from fossil fuels faster and faster.
So what has been the reaction to this outcome?
This summit has been pretty widely seen as a disappointment. While the final agreements were being adopted in front of all the delegates and negotiators, there were objections from many of them, including those from the EU and Colombia and Panama. Here is what the Panamanian Special Representative on Climate Change, Juan Carlos Monterrey, had to say outside of that final meeting.
It's honestly quite a joke. It does not mention the phase out of fossil fuels. It does not mention a roadmap to end deforestation, two of the primary sources of the crisis that we're here to debate and to fix.
Former Vice President Al Gore also released a statement that said petrostates and their political allies are doing everything they can to try to stop the world from making progress on solving the climate crisis.
Is there anything that came out of the summit that's being seen as a success?
Yeah, there are two things that I will highlight that many folks are pleased to see agreed on. The first is a new pledge of money from richer countries to more vulnerable ones to help them adapt to the impacts of climate change that they already are feeling. For example, like, you know, building seawalls in coastal cities to protect against sea level rise, for example. Countries agreed to try to at least triple the amount of that adaptation finance by 2035. Now, that is later than many countries would have liked and with weaker wording, but it still would mean about $120 billion by 2035 if that commitment is met.
So one concrete outcome. What else?
This is a little bit wonkier and in the weeds, Marco, but one of the final texts agreed to in Brazil recognizes the need for what's called a just transition, which basically means nobody being left behind in the transition away from fossil fuels. So, for example, maybe retraining workers at coal-fired power plants or ensuring that people whose crops have died because of the impacts of climate change, you know, can still make a living. So that and then a work plan put forward on the just transition is seen as a big win.
So a couple of bright spots. Is there anything you found noteworthy over the past 2 weeks?
You know, Marco, we've been looking at the impact of these summits over the years and what real world significance they actually have. But I wanted to end on this reflection from Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland, who said, at a time when multilateralism is being tested, it is significant that countries continue to move forward together.
Despite the spotlight on the Jeffrey Epstein scandal in the U.S. and the U.K., the problem at the center of it, sex trafficking, persists. Today and tomorrow, the U.N. General Assembly is holding a high-level meeting on efforts to end human trafficking. Ilias Tsatsis leads the U.N. office that deals with human trafficking.
What we need to do is basically make sure that the issue remains high on the political agenda, and it's expected they will adopt unanimously a declaration about the steps we all need to take forward.
Tsatsis spoke with us about the international criminal networks that are behind the problem.
The traffickers usually target people that, you know, have no means or financial means. Usually they traffic them for different also purpose. Sometimes it's not only sex trafficking, it's also trafficking for drugs. So the exploitation can take multiple shapes, but it takes the trafficking takes advantage of the victim's vulnerable financial situation and the need for them basically sometimes even to live, you know, to survive.
We know sex trafficking impacts every nation on Earth, but are there parts of the world that are more central to this industry than others?
Sex trafficking is more prevalent in affluent countries. So in the Western countries, you know, parts of Asia, that's where it is, if not the most prevalent form, at least equal to trafficking for forced labor.
How are the victims controlled after they've been trafficked to another country?
The control can be through different means. It can be, first of all, the most obvious means, which is the taking out of passports, the constraints of their ability to move freely. They lock them up often. But there are also much more subtle, if you want, means, but they are equally effective, which are means such as, for example, the debt bondage or forced marriages. It's a crime that cannot fit in one, you know, form. And I would say that almost every case is an individual case of trafficking. But one thing that is quite important to note is that trafficking is heavily organized. So 75%, almost 75% of all cases globally are organized crime.
Talk more about that, because when we talk about organization of trafficking, I mean, we often think of organized crime, but who specifically?
More than 7 out of 10 traffickers are members of gangs, members of organized crime gangs that are dealing also drugs, that are dealing arms, that are also smuggling people. So the trafficking crime is, in a way, entangled with all these different forms of crime.
Can you talk a bit about how technology and the internet facilitate business operations like recruitment and advertising?
Internet changed the game totally. It not only provided a totally new framework where basically the victim may be in one country, the perpetrator in another, and the server in a third, and the user in a fourth country, which creates tremendous problems in international cooperation for countries to address. It also introduced a new element in trying to investigate this crime, which is the private companies that are holding the data, that are holding the conversation, that can provide all the evidence that law enforcement need in order to prosecute effectively this crime.
These billions that these traffickers are making, how are money laundering and financial transactions actually handled by these networks?
Through fraudulent means that are most of them online, through cryptocurrency and through fraudulent online transactions. So that's where I think the private sector needs to come in with a much more forceful response to the current situation, take much more active, you know, stance, and really come forward with solutions and really a helping hand to law enforcement authorities when they're trying to investigate these cases.
Ilias, what would you say are the remedies for the mostly women and girls who are the victims of these crimes?
It's difficult to say, because one thing that it's clear, it's not the fault of the individual that they fell victims to trafficking, because the traffickers take advantage of very vulnerable situations that the people find themselves in, the stigma that these people carry. They have to be relieved from the stigma. And one of our main goals should be to help the victims really get back on their feet, get control of their lives, and try to put this thing behind them. And that's not an easy thing to do.
Ilias Tsatsis is the chief of the Human Trafficking and Migrant Smuggling Section at the United Nations. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. U.S. and Ukrainian officials wrapped up talks in Geneva today. Both sides said they've made progress on a plan to end the war. It is still not clear exactly what has been agreed to, but Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky described this juncture as critical.
We are working closely with the United States, with European partners, with many, many others to define steps that can end Russia's war against us, against Ukraine, and bring real security.
A joint statement issued today by European foreign policy officials does mention security guarantees for Ukraine. It says Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine will shape European security for generations, and concludes that peace cannot be achieved by yielding to or rewarding the aggressor. Irish Foreign Minister Helen McEntee said the talks were a step in the right direction, but she reiterated the EU's bottom line.
There cannot be any agreement without Ukraine being front and center. There cannot be any agreement where land is taken or acceded by force. And we have to ensure that the security, not just of Ukraine, but of the EU as a whole, that is protected.
That's the view from Geneva. Meanwhile, the fighting on Ukraine's front line does not let up. A new documentary shows what that actually looks like. 2,000 Meters to Andreevka was produced by our partners at Frontline and the Associated Press, the team that previously made the Oscar-winning 20 Days in Mariupol. Filmmaker Mislav Chernov spoke with us about the new film that chronicles the 2023 fight for the village of Andreevka.
I followed several platoons, but one of them, their task was to liberate very small village on the outskirts of Bakhmut. And in order to do that, they needed to cross this forest, tiny forest surrounded by minefields, which is only 1 mile long. But it was so heavily fortified and the battles were so hard that it took them almost 3 months to do that.
Yeah, I mean, the geography of the story is really important. The way into Andreevka is through a 2,000-meter strip of forest, a very narrow strip of forest, which we see in this very impressive drone shot at the start of the film, surrounded on both sides by minefields pocked with craters. Here's the moment where you head out with the soldiers.
8:30 a.m. Our transport reaches the forest. One of the soldiers tells me, "It's like landing on a planet where everything is trying to kill you." But it's not another planet, I tell myself. It's the middle of Europe.
Not another planet, it's the middle of Europe. So describe the terrain, Mislav, of this forest and the fighting that you saw there.
Yeah, it did feel like another planet. And, you know, the thing is that this land, these fields, this little forest that are splitting fields, they are so familiar to me. This is the land of my childhood. Those are the same places you go to see your grandmother who lives in a village just like Andreevka. Those are the fields where you run, and those are the forests where you play hide and seek with your childhood friends. And then you arrive there and you see them all scarred with trenches, with mutilated with craters from the bombs, and there's constant buzzing of drones which are trying to drop grenade on you. There is constant whistling of bullets and shells over your head. You just move through that terrain and you're trying to recognize something that you know, but you can't. And that makes you so angry. That makes you want to tell that story of that land. And the saddest part is that when you cross that forest, when you walk all this way with the soldiers, and then when you arrive to the village, and then you realize that the village is also destroyed by war, destroyed by bombs, and what they are liberating is the name and the symbol.
Yeah, you're kind of anticipating the end of the film. What was the strategic importance of recapturing this village? I mean, the population is what, a couple of thousand?
The population of Andreevka, no, it's like maybe 100 people. It's a very
small. Even smaller.
Yeah, it's a very small village, but it's on the road. And that is one of the roads that are big supply roads to Bakhmut, a city that Ukrainians lost to Russian occupation several months before that. They lost it in May 2023, and it was a big loss and a symbolic loss because Bakhmut was holding for more than a year. So to take it back was part of the counteroffensive goal.
A stepping stone to get back more territory further to the east. Is that right?
Yes, yes. Being able to liberate Bakhmut, being able to liberate villages around it would be a big win for Ukraine.
Through this three-month slog for Ukrainian soldiers to get to this village of Andreevka, you show long, uninterrupted minutes of scenes of fighting, machine guns, grenades. You're listening for drones. You move from trench to trench. What do you want viewers to take away from seeing this?
You know, in the very beginning, again, I thought very much about my own community, about the soldiers who in normal life, if the war wasn't there, would be my friends, would be my colleagues. One of them is from the rival university, you know, so just connection with this man and trying to tell their story and their perspective and their struggle and trying to show how Ukrainians really pushed back. But over the year, it became so much more. And some of them, unfortunately, died later. And it became so important for me to save their stories for their families. I think it's very important for all of us to see what the realistic experience of soldiers, how unacceptable, how terrible the war is. What is the modern warfare right now? So potentially what, you know, American soldiers would go through, potentially what European soldiers would go through if Russia attacks Europe. So it tells more than the story of Ukrainian soldiers. Right now it tells the story of what could happen to any of us if the world slides to war.
Yeah, modern war technology with World War I trench-to-trench battles. I'm speaking with filmmaker Mstislav Chernov and his new documentary, 2,000 Meters to Andriivka. The Ukrainian troops do eventually make it to Andriivka. Describe what they found when they got there.
Yeah, they make it to Andriivka, and it's horrifying because while Russians are retreating from Andriivka, they are indiscriminately firing on it with artillery. Just because Ukrainians are now in it and they are destroying whatever was left out of it. And there is hardly a place to raise the flag. And so we are sitting in this basement and we're pounded by artillery strikes and stones from the remains of the house falling on our helmets. And we're just waiting for artillery to stop hitting us to run out and film how the commander Fedya raises the flag over the village. And that's liberating in one way, in the way that the goal was finally achieved, and it's sad at the same time because, well, the village is destroyed. But you see the optimism there is in the eyes of these soldiers. You see optimism, irrational optimism, and you hear irrational optimism in their words when they say, this is all going to be rebuilt. This village will be rebuilt one day. And I truly believe that. It will take a lot of time.
Was that the victory these soldiers were expecting? I mean, liberating an abandoned, destroyed village?
I think the victory for a soldier is fulfilling their task and giving hope. The picture of the flag is almost as important as the liberated village itself, because they know that the picture of the flag will go so far, will go to every home in Ukraine, to millions of people, and will give this millions of people hope. They're not fighting for the village. They're fighting for their home. And, you know, if I had to fight for a house that I built with my hands and somebody came and destroyed it, I would still fight for the ruins until the end, because that is where I grew up. That is where my family lived. And there is no other answer to that.
I mean, you get to this village where there's basically no life. I mean, 200 people, some odd people, all gone. Except in an odd contrast, the soldiers find a cat.
Oh, you're spoiling all the film now. I spoiled the destroyed village.
We'll cut that out.
You're spoiling the cat. Let's say there is, despite of all the destruction, all the sadness and loss, there is one little ray of hope, ray of sun that the soldiers find there in that village. And I think that's the symbol of that hope, of the ability of humans, not just Ukrainians, of amazing ability of humans to find hope, even in total destruction.
Let's talk about how this film was shot. I mean, from the perspective of being in the trenches, it has an eerie parallel, and I can't believe I'm saying this, with realistic war films. But those are dramatized. This film is not. It's real. Technically speaking, how did you shoot this?
Yes, this film has quite interesting structure. It combines both body cam, helmet camera footage, and the footage that was shot with my camera when I was in the trenches. And so we switch from one perspective to another perspective throughout the film as we walk through the forest, and we flash back to the battles that were happening in the places where we are walking through. And that gives us a possibility to bring the audience like never before. You're able not just to witness what what the real war is these days, but also kind of experience it with your body, looking through the eyes of soldiers.
The soldier body cams is obviously a rich source of incredible video. Why do Ukrainian soldiers have helmet cams?
They have it for purpose of the battlefield analysis. They have it for the purposes of putting it to their own YouTube channels. Almost every brigade has its presence in social networks, and they put out the videos they shoot for their subscribers, for people who support them. So our job was to add more cameras to them and make sure we have all the materials that our protagonists were shooting.
Mstislav, in case it wasn't obvious so far, I just want to pause and relay to our listeners just what you were confronting and your team as you filmed these Ukrainian soldiers, because for a fraction of these 3 months, you were also in the sights of the drones and the suicide drones. And the Russians, as you point out, don't care if you're wearing the navy blue media flak jackets, correct?
Oh, they don't care. They would target you if you are. Journalist is a priority target, especially the camera that follows the flag. The war is happening on two levels, in media space and in the physical space. And picture of the flag is more important historically and from the moral point of view, strategic point of view, than the actual flag of the village. And so they would target you. They would kill you if they know you there. And you see that in the past months, there have been 5 journalists that have been already killed in Ukraine, and they've been killed by, most of them been killed by drones. So the pilots knew that they're targeting journalists, and they're killing specifically someone with a camera.
The front line in Ukraine, it's about 800 miles long. You show us what it's like to fight for about 1 mile. Are you putting reality to this clinical phrase we hear sometimes, a war of attrition?
Of course, it is a war of attrition. Of course, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to show what it is to fight for 1 mile of land. And that actually just shows how committed they are to protecting their homes and how inspiring it is. They're not afraid of hundreds of thousands of soldiers that Russia is ready to throw on Ukrainian land to gain another kilometer, another mile. They are fighting back for their own homes. And I think it's just sad that it's happening. It's just sad that this dark, violent army every day eating more and more and more of land that I call home, that we all call home, and destroys more and more and more cities. But at the same time, seeing Ukraine survive, seeing it survive as a nation, as a community, gives me hope.
Your previous documentary on Ukraine, 20 Days in Mariupol, this one 2,000 meters to Andriivka. I mean, if we go back to Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014, this conflict has been measured in days and meters. And like your film shows us, it seems to go nowhere. Is this film a microcosm of the whole war?
I strongly disagree with you here. You say it's going nowhere. But I have to tell you that if you think about this war as conflict or invasion or a contest for kilometers, that seems to go nowhere. But remember this. This is war for survival. Russians are just there to get more land. And for them, it seems to be going nowhere. But Ukrainians are there to survive. This is just pure fight for life. Someone came to kill you, and you are trying to survive and make sure that you and your family is not killed. That is not a war for kilometers. There is not war that doesn't make sense. It is actually war that where you either live or you die. And Ukrainians were choosing to fight for their lives. So if you, it's just a matter of perspective. It's a matter of survival for each of us. And if we give up, then we die. And I don't want to die. I don't want my family to die. I don't want my community to die. I don't want my city to be occupied. And so, yeah, it is where it is. It is terrible. But at least we're alive.
Mstislav Chernov, thank you very much for coming in and telling us about this remarkable, sobering film of the war in Ukraine. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Mstislav Chernov spoke with us earlier this month. His new feature documentary for GBH's Frontline is 2,000 Meters to Andriivka. It premieres tomorrow night on PBS.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. I, for one, am looking forward to apple pie later this week. Apples are on many a Thanksgiving table, but they did not originate in North America. They come from Central Asia. That history could prove crucial for the future of the fruit. This story by Levi Bridges in Kyrgyzstan is a favorite from our vault.
In the U.S., most commercial farms only grow about a dozen kinds of apples. Most of them are well-known varieties, like Macintosh or Honeycrisp. But having a small number of beloved varieties, which might be good for marketing, isn't great for biodiversity. And when you're only growing a couple types of apples, a new disease can do a lot of damage. And that's why a surprising discovery in Bulatbek Tagayev's backyard is such a big deal. Until recently, Tagayev had no idea that the world's rarest apple tree was growing on his property, a wild apple tree that isn't part of the grocery store stock. I went to check it out last week.
Wow.
Actually, I've got not just one, but two of these trees, he says, laughing and gloating just a little. Tagayev leads me down a hillside on his property in the small Kyrgyz village of Gumhana, right up to one of the trees. He says that in the spring, the tree blossoms are all red, not white, and even the fruit inside has a pinkish tone. What strikes me looking at this tree for the first time is the smooth reddish bark. It's a gorgeous tree. As rain patters down, Tagayev leads me into a dark forest nearby, where some of the world's first apples appeared, a species called Malus sieversii. Here are Malus sieversii. I'm surprised just how many of them there are. Although their numbers are significantly dwindling, these trees aren't currently endangered. This apple's a little rotten, but I'm going to try it anyway. It's good. For a rotten apple, it's very good. To be clear, this apple isn't ready for prime time. But before cultivation, a lot of the world's first apples weren't that tasty. Many were quite small, more like crab apples. It took centuries of people selecting the nicest apples to create big, juicy varieties like Granny Smith that you find today in supermarkets. At a cafe in the capital, I meet conservationist Jarkin Samanchina over tea and, what else, an apple dessert.
Tarte flambé with apples and cream cheese.
This is delicious, by the way.
Even if some of the wild apples aren't as flavorful, they're still incredibly valuable.
Scientists want to get more information about, you know, resistance to various diseases or to climate change.
So far, results show that Central Asia's apples are much hardier than U.S. trees. That's because commercial varieties of U.S. apples come from a very narrow gene pool. Avais Khan is a professor at Cornell who studies Central Asia's apples.
You will see a lot of diversity when you're going into a naturally growing apple tree forest in Central Asia. Every single plant will be genetically different from the other one.
Your typical red delicious, on the other hand, not so much. Trees on many U.S. apple farms are so genetically similar that a single disease can easily wipe out an entire orchard. But by crossbreeding a commercial apple with a Central Asian one, you can create more disease-resistant varieties. Scientists at Cornell have established an entire orchard of Central Asian apple trees they're preserving for future doomsday scenarios. Khan works on that project.
There could be many more diseases in the future, many more pathogens. Therefore, the Central Asian apple, all of them are important because you never know which trait you need.
Wild Asian apples could save the day, but they can still be susceptible to threats. Back in the village of Gumhana, a local shows me an apple tree afflicted by a disease called fire blight. She says the whole tree is sick. All the leaves are brown and withered up. Fabio Brazzonico is a researcher in Switzerland studying fire blight in Kyrgyzstan. He says, so far, apple forests in Central Asia have been spared from a major fire blight epidemic. But he worries because it's very contagious.
The disease can be spread by insects, so like pollinators can move and bring the disease from one tree to the other.
That's why they're going to such great lengths to protect the seeds now. In Gumhana, a conservationist unlocks a gate to show me a nursery where wild seedlings of endangered apples grow. They'll eventually be replanted in nearby forests. But grazing livestock and humans searching for firewood are slowly destroying the woods here. Habitat loss is such a dire threat, and the trees are so vital for maintaining the world's future apples, that Cornell researchers are storing backups of Central Asia's apple trees in liquid nitrogen and sending seeds to people all over the world.
And that is also another way of maximizing conservation.
So in that sense, the number of wild apple trees are still growing, even as Asia's ancient apple forests are getting smaller. For the world, I'm Levi Bridges in Gumhana, Kyrgyzstan.
And now a tribute to Jimmy Cliff, who died today at 81. Many people around the world got to know him as a musician and actor through the 1973 feature film, The Harder They Come.
You didn't believe me. Didn't I tell you I was going to be famous one day?
In the movie, Jimmy Cliff plays a musician seeking revenge on a shady record producer.
Hits from the movie's soundtrack became classics in reggae and beyond.
Many rivers to cross, and it's only my will that keeps me alive.
Many Rivers to Cross recalls a tough time in Cliff's life. When he left Jamaica for London in the late 60s, chasing stardom, he described that period to The Guardian a few years ago.
At one point, it seems as if the aspirations and dreams were not really coming through. So I guess all of those desperation and hurt and all of that was incorporated in that song.
With The Harder They Come, Jimmy Cliff secured his rightful place in reggae history. We leave you with a song he produced in the UK before returning to Jamaica, a cover of Cat Stevens' Wild World.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more, fjc.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.